welcome to Frank Buckley Interviews. It's the holiday season. I was planning to run a repeat with one of our previous guests, but given the circumstances that we find ourselves in, a pandemic that is out of control, Christmas and New Year's upon us, and what that means in terms of a potential bigger explosion of COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations and deaths, after the holidays, I felt it was important that we take advantage of being able to speak to one of the voices that we have come to trust throughout this pandemic. Dr. Anne Ramoyne, as those of you who are watching right now can see, of UCLA is with us. If you've been following us on the KTLA Morning News or reading of any of the national newspapers or watching the national news broadcasts, you know Anne Ramoyne, but she's a professor in the Department of Epidemiology at UCLA. She's the director of the Center for Global and Immigrant Health and the director of the UCLA DRC Health Research and Training Program in the UCLA Jonathan and Karen Fielding School of Public Health. Anne, welcome once again.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, and here we are again. Let's start with how bad things are right now here in California, and specifically in Southern California. Health officials are telling us that this is the worst moment of the pandemic to date. What does that mean in real terms?
Well, what that means, Frank, is that we are seeing just explosive spread of COVID-19 right here in Southern California. And we've talked about this before. We've seen these warnings about cases and that the rates are going up. But the truth of the matter is we have a wildfire of cases here in California just spreading out of control. We've seen a lot of different estimates coming out of the Department of Health, but I think the most recent number that I've heard is 1 in 64 people in LA County are walking around with COVID-19, potentially infectious and able to spread to other people. And if you think
and
about
is that, just let me just ask, just to put that in perspective, 1 in 64 in LA County has it or has had it?
What
is that number?
Currently
has it actively.
And can potentially be spreading it to other people. That is the estimate right now. You know, it's what this, and this is really like, this is how we should be thinking about it. In August, we estimated that 1 in 800 people were walking around infectious with COVID-19. Right before Thanksgiving, we estimated it around 1 in 145. And then just the other week, we were saying 1 in 100. Now we're down to 1 in 64 people. And I've heard estimates between 1 in 50, 1 in 64. I mean, at this point, it really doesn't make that much of a difference. We're splitting hairs here. I think what this people's the take home message here is this thing is spreading wildly. It is everywhere. It's like a viral storm outside is the way that I look at it. And I am not somebody that's speaking in hyperbole in normal circumstances here, but this virus is spreading everywhere. And so the way to think about it, if you think 1 in 800 over the summer, 1 in 64 right now, the chances of you coming in contact with somebody else who is infectious with COVID-19 right now is significantly higher. So all the things that you were doing before where you thought, okay, well, maybe I'm safe, maybe I can get away with it, maybe the risk isn't that high, it's different right now. Right now, the risk is very high.
And here's the question. I feel in Southern California, we have largely followed the rules. We've been, you know, people have finally gotten it. Social distancing, you know, wearing masks, washing their hands, doing what they can to do the right things. And yet we have become the center of the pandemic. So how did that happen?
Well, you know, I think that the thing is LA County is the most populous county in the US. And we have a lot of people here. We have a lot of essential workers. We have a lot of multi-generational households. And we we were able to bring the numbers down for a while, but it was spreading and it just started to burn through the population. And it's like a snowball, right? It starts to gain momentum, it gains speed, it becomes denser, heavier, and it's much harder to stop. And so I think that that's really what's happened here is we have so many people, the virus has had plenty of opportunity to spread, and it's just taking those opportunities. Anybody that is susceptible is at risk. And I think that people just started to let their guard down, and the virus started taking opportunity to spread, and it's just this force of infection and this momentum that's causing it. I think that that's the real explanation here. And before Thanksgiving, we had so many cases and people got together for Thanksgiving. And so it just continued to spiral in that sense.
And is that your fear about the holidays? We've had Hanukkah, now we're into Christmas this weekend. Mm-hmm. Following that, we'll have New Year's Eve and New Year's Day. People get together, you know, for all of those events. What could happen in January and February?
I mean, we're looking at a very, very difficult period here. Listen, 1 in 64 people are walking around potentially infectious with COVID-19 right now here in LA County. And if they are spreading it to other people, you can imagine how quickly this can escalate. Our hospitals are already overwhelmed. The ICU, we are at 0% ICU capacity right now. So we really can't even stop where we're going for the next couple of weeks, you know, for the next few weeks. But we can, you know, if everything that somebody does now will have an impact a couple weeks down the road. So everybody needs to stay home if they can. There are people, now we have to be realistic here. There are people who cannot stay home. We have essential workers. We have people who have jobs that they cannot avoid going to. There are things that people have to do, but anybody that can stay home should stay home. The more people that are out of circulation, the better it is for the entire community, because this virus has fewer places to go. And again, you just have to think, you know, grocery stores have been implicated. There was that story in the LA Times just yesterday about the grocery stores being implicated. You know, it just makes sense. I mean, any place where you see lots of people going in and out of, that's where you're going to see virus spreading. You know, it's just, so everybody that can stay home should stay home. It's hard to internalize that, I think, to think, well, but I, you know, if I just go to the grocery store this time, or if I just do this at this time, it's very, very complicated for people you know, it's one thing to say it, but then to internalize it is a very, very different thing, to be able to say, okay, well, that means I'm not going to the grocery store. I'm going to order, you know, using an app if I can. And what things, I think everybody has to take stock and think, what are the things that I can avoid doing right now? These are concrete things that I can do to avoid getting this virus. And there are a couple of other things that I think people are just not aware of right now. And they are, if you have been exposed to somebody, if somebody calls you and says, hey, I tested positive for COVID-19, or if somebody in your household tests positive for COVID-19, that means, especially in your household, somebody in your household tests positive for COVID-19, from the minute that you understand that somebody has tested positive, you need to leave work or wherever you are and go home, because you are a close contact and you need to quarantine. Now, if somebody calls you and said, hey, I tested positive for COVID-19, if you were around them 2 days prior to that diagnosis, those are the official guidelines here. 2 days prior, we usually say for contact tracing, 2 days prior, 48 hours prior to that positive test. So when that sample was actually taken and you were with them for 15 minutes cumulatively. So that doesn't mean just a 15-minute block of time. That means 15 minutes over a 24-hour period. So you went up to somebody, you walked away, you went up to somebody, you walked away. That means that you are a contact and you need to quarantine. And that's a really hard thing. I think people just don't think about it when it comes to their own life. And I've had a lot of experience with this in the last few days, just helping people who they call me, they ask me what's going on, you know, having to parse through this. They say, oh, well, you know, my husband's at work, so when he gets home from work, I'll tell him. No, if you test positive, everybody in your household if you're living together, needs to stop what they're doing and come home and start quarantining.
And those people, so let's say in that case, that wife found out that she is positive. Mm-hmm. She calls her husband and says, I'm positive, you need to come home because there's potential that you've been infected and you don't want to infect your coworkers.
Right.
But once he does get home, does he then isolate from her? Do they live in separate rooms? How does a family do that when you all live together?
This is a really, really complicated situation. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you exactly what the LA County Department of Health says to do here. Now, you can go to publichealth.lacounty.gov where the instructions are very clearly online. So publichealth.lacounty.gov. But here's what they tell you right now. In Los Angeles County, if you have been in close contact with a person diagnosed with COVID-19, you are required to stay home and separate yourself from others for 10 days. And you should monitor your health for 14 days. Now, this is important. You know, beforehand, we were saying the number of days has changed over time. The only reason that those numbers have changed is because we realized that people just were not quarantining for the full 14 days. It's not that you cannot test positive up to 14 days. It's just that we know that people were not actually able to do it. So this is a sense of like, let's not let great be the enemy of good. So if you can quarantine right. for 14 days, great. But 10 days is the minimum here. Now, The caveat here is if you've had a COVID positive test in the last 90 days, you should talk to your doctor about whether or not you do need to quarantine. It's just a question of if you've already been infected, what that happens. But okay, so then we need to go through here is if you're a close contact, what does a close contact mean? You're a close contact if you were in 6 feet of someone with COVID-19 for a total of 15 minutes or more over a 24-hour period, right? So not 15 minutes at a time, but 15 minutes total in a 24-hour period. And that's really, really important. Now, this question that you were just saying about what do you do if you live with this person? Now, LA County has guidelines right now about this. And what they say is if you live or care for the person with COVID-19 in your family, if you can avoid close contact, your last day of quarantine is after 10 days from when that person tested positive. But if you have close contact with them again while they're still in isolation, your 10-day quarantine period will have to restart from that last day that you had contact. And I think what's realistic for most family members is this last piece. If you can't avoid close contact, your last day of quarantine is 10 days from the date that that person with COVID-19 was told that their isolation ends, right? Mm-hmm. So that means, a person tests positive. We tell people that they should isolate for 10 days. So if you live in a household with somebody who is COVID-19 positive and you can't stay away from this person, which is normal, like I want to make sure that that's not a judgment. That's just you can't stay away from them.
Right.
Then your quarantine ends 10 days after that COVID positive diagnosis. So that's 20 days.
Yeah, unless you test a long time.
In the middle of that, right? And then your isolation starts from the day that you test positive for 10 days.
And that sort of explanation goes to, I think, what a lot of people are dealing with here. There's so much information that's been coming at them from the beginning of all of this. And some of it has been a patchwork of messaging. So even when it comes to the holidays, LA County has an emergency order that went into place, I think on December 2nd, that essentially said people got text alerts in the evening saying you can't leave your house. You're not supposed to leave your house. You're not supposed to ride your bike, take a car, get on a bus, do anything to leave your house, except for 41 exceptions. And there are all these, you know, different rules. And, you know, for the holidays, Dr. Fauci said, you know, I'm not canceling Christmas. Just make your gatherings smaller. What does that mean? You know, I think people don't understand, you know, are you saying we can get together or we can't get together?
This is the problem with public health messaging, is that we're trying to, we all know what the smartest, safest thing to do is. The smartest, safest thing that anybody can do is to not spend time with anybody else outside their household and to avoid all things that put them in contact with other people, if possible. Okay. So that is the bar that we can start to say, this is the safest thing for you to do. The problem is that people still go and do things. And so public health is trying to find a way to be able to say, okay, well, we know you're going to probably, you know, many people will probably do something. So here are some guidelines. So for people who want to be as safe as they possibly can, the answer is stay home unless absolutely necessary. Order in, do all of these kinds of things that you can, and avoid contact with people outside your own household. That is the safest thing. Period. Yeah. That is the safest thing to do. And I would advise anybody that can do that should do that. It's not only a good idea for their own health and safety, but it's a really good idea for society because we're pulling, it's like de-risking. It's like literally the more people you can pull out of circulation, the better it is. Now, for people who say, well, I can't do that, or I'm not going to do that, the next best thing to do is to limit the number of people that are going to get together. And to do it outside, masked and socially distant. I know that people really want this. You know, everybody wants a guarantee of safety and what they can do that guarantees that they're going to be safe. Again, the only safe thing that you can do is stay home and stay away from other people. The next best thing to do is to limit contact with other people as much as you can, do it outdoors and masked and socially distant. And I want to make a point about this masked and socially distant thing. There was just a study that came out today, and I believe it was the Journal of Fluid Mechanics. Maybe I can't remember which one it was, but anyway, it was a physics.
I don't get that one, Anne Ramoy. I don't get the fluid mechanics.
My subscription isn't up to date either. No, but the thing is that physicists made a machine and put masks on these machines and simulated what it was for people to cough and to sneeze and to breathe. And they found that all masks, except for N95, so one for healthcare workers, that some virus was still getting through. Mm-hmm. Now, it significantly reduced the amount of virus that was getting through, but still some virus did get through. And that's why it's masks plus social distancing. You can't wear a mask and use that instead of social distancing. So it's like a layered approach here. Now, this is not saying, I want to make this real clear. It is not saying that masks don't work. Masks work, but they are not 100% effective. So everything is about layering this risk reduction. So masks plus social distancing. And then you want the added benefit outside.
Well, let me ask you about that, this idea of harm reduction versus abstinence, right? There was an article in the LA Times that really caught my attention a few weeks ago. It was this idea that, yes, we should make sure that we continue to tell people to socially distance, to mask up, but give people the information and make relatively low risk activities okay. Because when you say to people, you can't do anything, then they just sort of give up and they throw up their arms. And I'll give you an example. Just in my own life, until 3 weeks ago, when this, you know, severe emergency order came out from the mayor's office here in LA, most weekends my wife and I would have another couple over and we would sit outside. They would sit at the other end of the picnic table and we would sit on this end. It was bring your own. They brought their own food and drinks and we brought our own. But it was a chance to socialize and at least see other people once a week. And we did that and we remained healthy. But then this order came out and we thought, gosh, are we not even allowed to do that anymore? So we haven't. But I can see how people, the fatigue sets in. And there are some quotes that I just want to run by you. One was from Dr. And these are people I'm sure you know, Monica Gandhi, who's an infectious disease specialist at UC San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And she said, people are not ignoring guidance because they're irresponsible. It's because, quote, they are losing trust in public health officials who put out arbitrary restrictions. She said, we are failing in our public health messaging, something that you sort of spoke to earlier. And then Julia Marcus, who's an infectious disease researcher at Harvard University, she said that banning small outdoor gathering does little to stop the spread, could backfire. Quote, outdoor gatherings that are masked and distanced, that's a place where we can give people a break so they can avoid situations we really want them to avoid, like crowds and indoor parties. She goes on to say the thing that can save LA is getting people outdoors instead of, and instead there are these policies that may actually do the opposite by forcing people inside. And so what was your reaction when you saw that article?
Well, I think this is exactly, you put it perfectly. It's all about harm reduction. But I think that the public health messaging around this has to be so nuanced. It goes back to, again, okay, if you want to be really, really safe, I can tell you exactly what you need to do to be really, really safe. It's all about what kind of risk you are personally willing to take and what your risk factors are. And then this issue of what can you do to give people mental health outlets, right? But still keep people mostly safe. Now, the problem is that there's always, you know, it's really, really hard to get people to do the right thing. Everybody's trying to kind of push the edges on this, right? So you might be doing things as safely as possible, but people next to you might not be. And it's really important to really understand what the risks, you know, what these other people's risks are. So, I mean, I agree with that. I think getting people outside is definitely going to minimize risk. No guarantee that you're not going to get coronavirus. Mm-hmm. There's no guarantee, but the probability is significantly lower if you are outside, masked, and socially distant. But you have to do all three things, and you got to do them right. So I think that this public health, you know, this weighing of public health messaging, I've been spending a lot of time thinking about this issue of science communication and public health messaging. And I just think that the public health community isn't used to having to be as slick and dynamic and capable of messaging and being able to shift as information gets out and be able to pivot and to explain to people how fluid this situation is. And as we learn more, we're going to give you more information and we're going to try and...
Pablo, call this center.
There may be something that...
Sorry about that. I'm in the newsroom, so there's a little bit of noise. Apologies about
that. It's totally fine. You got, you know, dogs barking in my background. So it's totally fine. but the thing is that public health messaging is really hard. And it's hard because, you know, this issue of things changing over time, it makes it very complicated for people. And people want to say, they're saying, listen, I'm following these rules. Why am I now having to change? And it's just this issue of, this is a new virus. We're learning things all the time. And so we're going to give you the best guidance right now. And then it may change again. And we're sorry, but this is for everybody's benefit. This is for the benefit of society. We're doing the best we can with what we know. So in terms of the
holiday, as we're coming up on Christmas and New Year's, in terms of a bottom line, if there is one, the best is, sorry, this Christmas we're not getting together. I'm going to stay at home in my pod with the people that I see every day, mm-hmm. and you're going to stay where you stay. The next level up is, if you're going to have a small gathering, do it outside and mask up.
Yep.
And then everything after that is just degrees of risk that you're adding. Is that a good way to look at it?
Right. And if for all of these reasons that, you know, you need to see some people or you really feel compelled to see other people, then what I suggest probably another person calling me asking me what to do. that what you do is you do it outside, socially distant and masked, and have the smallest number that you can than you can have. The fewer people involved, the smaller the risk. Now, what I would the other thing is
if you eat
and drink, right? That's where things get tricky, because you're taking your mask off, right? It's better outside, but you want to really have that distance as far as you can. That's the key, is being as socially distant as possible.
Okay. And then I wanted to ask you about the outdoor dining controversy. And clearly, you know, restaurants have done everything they can to try to comply with all the rules over the past 10 months. Some of them have managed to stay alive, thank God. Others could not. And those who were what they thought doing the right thing, then this outdoor dining ban goes into effect, and they felt scapegoated. And one of the things that they have said is, look, there's no data that's specific to outdoor dining. And so why is it that you can allow some retail to remain open or some, you know, other things to remain open, but outdoor dining, which is one of these outlets we've talked about, that all shuts down because all of these businesses are now, you know, at risk of going under?
Well, the issue is about people coming from different households into a common place and sitting in relatively close proximity with their masks off for an extended period of time and doing things which are potentially generating droplets. That's the inherent problem with the outdoor dining scenario here, is that even if you are 6 feet apart, there's no guarantee. And people sitting at these tables often are coming from different households. I mean, that's how, you know, it's not people from your own household just going out to dinner. It's often people from other places coming together and sitting, you know, at a table in close proximity for an extended period of time with masks off, eating and drinking, and not sitting, you know, your picnic table, you're sitting 6 to 10 feet away from each other. But in these restaurant settings, you have people from other households getting together and sitting in very close proximity and eating with each other. And so it's just logistically, it's very complicated. I mean, my heart is breaking for all of these restaurants. So difficult. It's so complicated. And it's not that these restaurants aren't trying to do the right thing. They are trying to do the right thing. It's just this issue of how do you do it safely, where people who are, you know, how do you enforce it, and how do you keep people safe, and how do you keep these numbers down? Because it's not about penalizing people. It's about exactly what we're seeing right now. We're just trying to protect people from harm. And the fact is that our hospitals are overwhelmed and there are no ICU beds, and care is about to be rationed here, right here in the United States, right here in Southern California, because there are not enough health workers, not just not enough beds, but it's not enough health workers to be able to manage what's happening. So it's about harm reduction at this point. And if you allow people to get together, provide opportunities for people to get together where they have their masks off, close proximity from multiple households, you can't guarantee their safety. And so that's the issue.
Let me ask you about travel, because the guidance is, please don't travel if you don't have to. Setting aside the fact that people like, you know, Dr. Deborah Birx said that at Thanksgiving and then traveled herself and got together with her family. And that's sort of what some people see as hypocrisy from our public health officials, from our elected officials who go to fancy restaurants and gather with multiple households when they've told us not to do that. Let's set that aside for a second, but just about the travel part of this. I had a friend who was in Hawaii recently who said to me, look, I went through the travel protocols. I took the testing in LA. I took the testing when I arrived. And when I got to Hawaii, life was good. I have another someone close to me who's saying, look, I'm going to go to Mexico because it's actually the numbers are safer in Mexico than they are here in LA. So this idea of travel is the travel issue that we're going to take COVID from here and take it somewhere else, that we're going to collect COVID along the way, or that it's unethical to travel? And what are your thoughts on travel?
It's all of the above. And again, this is a complicated situation. So here we are in Los Angeles right now. We have a lot of COVID. So we have the potential of taking it and spreading it to other people. We also, in the other direction, can also get it while you're traveling, because especially if you're traveling, I mean, let's be real about an airplane. An airplane is a metal tube with recirculated air. Now, the good news is that the ventilation systems in there are pretty good, but you have to get to the airport. You have to stand in line in TSA. You got to wait in the jet bridge. You have to use bathrooms that are common bathrooms. You can't control who's sitting next to you. There's so many of these uncontrolled factors. Yes, the airflow systems are pretty good at filtering air, but there are other, you know, everybody isn't just sitting there not moving and not looking at each other. And, you know, there are too many uncontrolled situations here. So that's why we're saying it's that you could be bringing it elsewhere. You could be getting it while you're traveling. You could get it where you go to, and you could bring it back. So that's the problem with all of it. And this goes back to if people who don't have to travel right now shouldn't travel. It goes back to this de-risking thing. Not everybody can avoid traveling. There are reasons that people have to travel. So you want everybody that can avoid it to avoid it. Save it for next year vaccines are on their way. Healthcare workers are getting vaccinated. We're going to have the people who are 75 and older getting vaccinated very soon. We're going to start seeing death rates and hospitalization rates go down when we start to see these populations vaccinated. So it's a matter of just holding on a little while longer. It's really hard for us. It's hard for all of us. It's hard for me too. It's really difficult. But we just need to do everything we can to avoid it. And I also agree with you. I think it's a real problem that for people in the public health and science and medicine, you know, we're giving all of this advice. We have to live by it too. You know, it's not fair to do otherwise. Now, Deborah Birx maybe being, you know, have access to testing and to other things that other people don't have available to them. But I would say, you know, now is the time to be the best example that you possibly can to others, and to sacrifice as much as everybody else has to sacrifice.
Let me ask you this about the point that Deborah Birx has access to testing. We can all kind of get tested now. We can get free testing through various LA County offered testing sites and through our doctors or whatever. We don't have to pay for it. It's free. Other people know that they have antibodies because they've tested positive and they've recovered. Is there a way to test yourself safe? In other words, Deborah Birx may have thought, well, look, I know that I'm safe because I've tested every day. I haven't been in touch with people who have COVID, as far as I know. I've been contact traced. Or maybe she's had it and she knows it. And so she has antibodies. Is there a way to test yourself safe for this holiday or at other times? And if you've had COVID, are you safe?
So, can you test yourself safe? So we all have to remember the limitations of testing here. Testing is a great tool, but it's only valid for that day. Like from when that swab was taken from you, that's the moment that you know that you're negative for COVID. If you get your results a day later, 2 days later, 3 days later, 4 days later, 5 days later, some people are still waiting a long time for turnaround. Those results are valid for that day that you were tested. So it can be very, very complicated for people to say, well, I'm negative, when you're not getting the results back really quickly. It's from that time period, and anything you've done from that time period onward, you know, counts. And also remember that COVID-19 has a, you know, you normally people can, they don't test positive for 5 to 7 days after exposure and up to 2 weeks. So, you know, if you also have to go backwards a little bit and think, okay, well, I could have been incubating and not tested positive yet. I could have a negative test and then a couple of days later test positive. So, you know, it's about what you were doing before. It's about what you were doing afterwards. So it does make it complicated. It's helpful. It's another data point. It suggests that at that moment you weren't positive, but you also have to remember there's still a high rate of false negatives, that people who are actually positive but test negative. Could be about how the swab was taken, could be about the test itself, the time of day, you know, just whether you were shedding or not at that moment. There are a lot of different reasons. So any test is not 100% guarantee that you're negative. There's still a chance that you have it and haven't tested positive for a variety of reasons. So there's no perfect scenario. It helps. It's better information than no information, but it's not perfect. So testing your way out of it, it's a little bit tricky to be able to rely on that 100%, but it's better than no info. So get okay. tested.
And then what about antibodies? If I have had COVID or I've tested just for antibodies and it reveals, yeah, you've been exposed. Can I now go to my, you know, big friend or family Christmas event and say, I'm okay. I've had it and I'm clean.
Well, that's a complicated question again. So what I would say is that if you have antibodies, then, and you still have antibodies because we know that antibodies can wane and, then it is likely that you have some immunity to the virus. We don't know how much, we don't know how long, and we don't know if you can get reinfected, have a low level of infection, and then pass it on to other people. We still don't know the answers to those questions. So there's no hard yes or hard no here. There's a, if you've had it in the last 90 days, we think that you're probably immune for at least that period of time. So if you've just had it, you have antibodies to it because not everybody creates immunity to it. But I would get my antibodies checked and you might be able to make that argument, but there's no guarantee. There's literally no guarantee here. So maybe. And so it's all just a matter of, I would talk to my doctor. I would look at the all of the results that I have and make that determination that way. I know that's not a reasonable thing for everybody to be able to do, but that's why we're all saying, still don't know enough about this virus. We're still trying to sort out what this all looks like and what it means. Maybe. So it's a matter about
To your point about not knowing everything about the virus, you've studied viruses. That's your world. And you've covered or been part of dealing with pandemics. This one has seen this virus mutate. And you've seen that before. And now we have this more contagious, I guess is how it's described, strain out of the UK. It's believed to be in the US by now. What does that mean? And does that mean that the vaccines that we've been hoping for, that you know, now that we have a more contagious strain, that it's not going to be helpful? Or is this another case of, well, we're not sure?
Again, so maybe. Okay, so here's the thing. Viruses mutate. All viruses mutate. This is not unexpected that the virus is going to mutate. We've seen lots of mutations already of this virus. And these mutations generally don't amount to much. I mean, we what happens is that a virus is going to mutate. It'll probably change its surface proteins. And then that's how we recognize, our immune system recognizes these surface proteins. We create antibodies against them. And it's like we recognize them. And that's how we're able to defend ourselves. So what we're seeing right now is we're seeing what's unique about this particular mutation is there are a bunch of different mutations that they saw here. I think there were 23 that they actually noticed in this particular variant of COVID-19. That's a lot of mutations kind of all together. That's number one. Number two, this became the most predominant strain in London between the beginning of September and now. And 6 out of 10 people with COVID-19 in London all of a sudden have this strain. Now, that suggests either it's more contagious, so more this strain is spreading more easily than other strains, or it got into a bunch of super spreader events, and that's how it all happened. Public Health England and the advisory committee in the UK say that they're pretty confident that this is much more contagious than other strains, and that's the reason why. And I would say, you know, that's a bunch of public health experts saying, you know, this is what we really think based on what we're seeing right now. And I tend to think, you know, they're probably right. So if this strain is more contagious, it's mutated, it's become more contagious, that means that more people are going to get the virus. It means that then just proportionately more people are going to end up needing hospitalization, ICU beds, more people are going to die. This particular variant is not, to our knowledge right now, more virulent, doesn't cause more severe disease, but still it can end up creating more disease and more death because more people will get infected. And we know that what that means is more people will get it. Now the thing about viruses like this, they're going to continue to mutate. And that's why this viral surveillance is so important. That's why we have to constantly not only be looking at the number of cases, what the constellation of symptoms are that people are having, see if that's changing at all, but we also need to be tying that back to the actual genetic footprint of this virus, fingerprint of this virus, and be able to say, okay, well, what's the structure of this virus that's infected this person, and what are their signs and symptoms compared to other people and be able to track that. And that's what the UK has been doing. And that's why they're saying, okay, this is what we're seeing, you know, alert, we're seeing something happening here. So the bottom line is viruses mutate. We see this all the time. That's why every year we need a new influenza vaccine that needs to be updated, because flu mutates so quickly that we need to be regularly updating vaccines. Other viruses like measles, for example, don't mutate that quickly. And that's why the vaccine you had 20 years ago is still effective today, because it doesn't mutate as quickly as this one. Coronaviruses, they mutate. They mutate quickly, not as quickly as flu, but quickly. So the question then is, okay, so now what? Well, we need to monitor this because we need to understand, are the vaccines still going to be effective? It appears that right now, the vaccines that we have right now are still effective against this particular set of mutations, and they probably will be for a while. But my guess is that over time, we're going to have to be revising this and looking at this. I think it's going to be very important as time goes on.
So it may be that even if we get vaccinated this year in 2021 and all of us eventually get vaccinated, or at least enough so that we develop this herd immunity so that the virus has nowhere to go, we may have to get another vaccine next year, some updated sort of vaccine, or maybe 2 years from now.
Correct. And we just don't know enough yet to know exactly what that's going to look like and what that's going to mean. Just we're still waiting to figure that out. So those
All right,
are the questions that people are asking right now. But this just shows you how important viral surveillance is, and that we can anticipate that this is going to happen.
Before I let you go, is there anything that you wanted to say? And the reason that I wanted to talk to you is you sent up a red flare to me a few days ago. And when you say, listen, I listen, because you were saying people are not getting it. How, you know, this position that we're in right now is a very frightening moment. And is there anything else you want to say that can help us to get that perspective or anything else that I forgot to ask you that you want to make sure that we get across?
Frank, I would say, so first of all, I want to thank you for that, because I think that public health communication, as we've discussed before, is so complicated, because it's this situation is very nuanced. It's not as simple as put your seatbelt on because you could get into an accident and you can save lives that way, because the science is changing every single day. We're learning more. I think that the thing that I think is so important for people to understand is it is more dangerous today than it was yesterday and the day before. And we're just, as these cases continue to increase, it's going to be more dangerous. And so we all have to modify our behavior as a result. And it's okay to cancel things. It's not rude. It's actually very, very thoughtful to say, I'm sorry, we can't do this right now. We can't get together. I don't feel comfortable getting together. And I think that giving people the okay to say, hey, you know what? Things are changing. If I can do something right now that's going to make a difference, I'm going to do it. Let's just make these gatherings not happen right now, or I'm going to not go to the grocery store. I'm going to order in. All these things that we can do cumulatively will make a difference. So anything that you can do, do it. It will save lives. That's the first thing that I would say to people. The second thing is for people who are saying, well, but I have to see other people. I have reasons I have to do it. Just please, outdoors, socially distanced, masked, and as few people as possible for as little time as possible. I think that those are really important. And then the next thing is going back to this. If somebody tests positive in your household, that means you need to quarantine because you are potentially exposed. And there's no shame in this. I think people still have there's a lot of stigma around this and thinking about what did I do wrong and how am I, this is not my fault. Why do I have to do this? And I get it. I get it. Believe me, I get that. It's not your fault. It's just, this is, the virus is spreading like wildfire. So if somebody in your household tests positive, it's okay. Just go home and quarantine and explain. People will understand. And if they don't understand, they will, because this is really happening to everybody. It's happening everywhere. And it's happening to not just people in a certain socioeconomic status or a certain neighborhood or a certain group. It's happening to everybody. The last thing I would want to impart upon people is that these vaccines are coming and they're starting to roll out and it's going to make a difference. This is really great news. And these vaccines are really showing to be safe and effective. And that is what is going to bring this to an end. So that's fantastic news. We don't have that much longer to go. It feels like it, but it's not that much longer. So hold on, get that vaccine when you can get it. And if you are concerned about whether or not you have the virus or you can spread the virus to other people, get tested. That's the right thing to do.
Well, great advice as always, Dr. Ramoine. If folks have a feedback for you, you're on Twitter at A. Ramoine.
Yes.
Correct. And I'm on Twitter at Frank Buckley TV, also on Instagram and on Facebook. Dr. Ramoine, Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays. Stay safe, and thanks so much for joining us for this special edition of Frank Buckley Interviews from my cubicle at the office.
It's my pleasure. Please stay safe and well. Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, and same to everybody who's listening.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of Frank Buckley Interviews. We will see you next week, and until next time, I'll see you on TV.